We'll listen now to some of the music that made Coleridge Taylor mean so much to so many. This is an excerpt from his Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, the first cantata in his trilogy, The Song of Hiawatha. Kazim Abdullah leads the 2017 Color of Music Festival Orchestra and Chorus for this performance.
Thank you.
That was an excerpt from Samuel Coleridge Taylor's Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, performed by the 2017 Color of Music Festival Orchestra and Chorus under Kazim Abdullah. We'll return now to a conversation with Samuel Coleridge Taylor biographer Charles Elford, who fills us in on the composer's time here in the United States.
I think he was seen as a cultural hero. It was unprecedented. He came again. That his first trip was in 1904. The second one, he was invited out again, and he toured and conducted at St. Louis and Detroit, Pittsburgh, Washington, Milwaukee. He went to Toronto. He was seen very differently there. He was seen as a cultural icon. On a slightly sad note, I think around this sort of time, that a little bit of his spark, I think, of the man actually began to leave him. It was around 1906, I believe, where poor Lawrence Dunbar died. And I think that shook him, because this wasn't an old man, and poor Lawrence Dunbar had developed TB and was working as a librarian. And I think he had an alcohol problem at the time as well. So he saw an early collaborator of his on a downward spiral, who eventually died. And the other one was William Hurlston, who was a great friend all his life, who at this point was a conductor and teacher at the Royal College of Music, where they both studied. He had a massive asthma attack on the steps between the Royal Albert Hall and the Royal College of Music, and just died on the spot, aged 29. And I think that devastated Coleridge Taylor. He carried on teaching. His workload was, you know, it was staggering when you look at how he was traveling, the fact that he was writing, he was conducting, he was lecturing, teaching. And around this time, again, some more Americans sort of got wind of him. There was a Carl Stokel, who I think was in Boston, again, paid for another trip for him to come out. This was around 1911, and obviously he died in 1912. So this is getting towards the end of his life. He's 36 years old at this point. He kept trying to repeat the early success he had with Hiawatha, but the impression is that he was living very hand to mouth, really, and still struggling financially, working nonstop. But he was he just seemed to be so well liked. Apparently, he really put people at their ease. He had a great sense of humour. He was very funny. He was very, very bright. And when he met people, people kind of said they ended up talking more about themselves than finding out about him. He was very interested in people. He liked hearing their stories. And he tried to repeat his success with Hiawatha by writing another choral piece called A Tale of Old Japan. Again, it was met very, very favourably. But what the Stokels wanted, and what he wanted to do, was to write a violin concerto. So they commissioned this piece from him in 1911 for the violinist, who, again, was a megastar of her day, Maud Powell. And this was going to be premiering in 1912 at the Norfolk Music Festival. So he, with this punishing, I can't stress enough the hours he worked, how hard he worked, and still maintained his good humour. So he wrote this violin concerto with not very much time in which to do it, and sent it off. And remember, everything's going by boat. There was no internet. There was no telephone. He didn't employ copyists. So every piece of music that the orchestra was playing from, he had written out by hand with pen and ink. So this was sent off eventually to the Stokels in March 1912, and they wrote back, and they were critical of it. And I think that devastated him. And they said, "Yeah, it's not quite what we had in mind. Can you do it again?" So he said yes, and started to burn the candle at both ends, and wrote this violin concerto a second time. And it left Southampton on the 10th of April, 1912, on the Titanic. So obviously never arrived. And he had to write it a third time in order to meet this deadline of the premiere, the public performance of this piece. He sent it off. He managed to do it. It arrived in America. But then in August, by this point, he hadn't known if it had arrived or not, this final version, and he was at West Croydon train station, which is a suburb of London where he lived, and he collapsed on the station platform and managed to struggle home, but got sicker and sicker and sicker. Interestingly, he had a strange dream a few weeks before this happened, where his old school friend, William Hurlston, came to him. And he said to his wife that the fact that in this dream that was so vivid, Hurlston wouldn't shake his hand, somehow meant to him, he was very adamant that that meant he was going to die soon. So he was waiting for the Stokels piece of music to come back to London so that it would meet the deadline for its premiere here, not knowing whether it had been received, whether they liked it, whether it had been performed. And eventually it did arrive, but he was on his deathbed by this point, and he and his wife counted out the musical parts to make sure everything was returned safely. And then he slipped into even deeper illness, and 4 days after his original collapse, he was seen conducting an invisible orchestra from his deathbed. His arms were moving slowly in the air above his body, and he just died. 1912, 1st of October, September, sorry, aged 37. And as I say, his death was seen as a huge tragedy, both here and in the US.
Of course, Coleridge Taylor lives on in a sense through his music, a little bit more of which we'll hear now. This is the aria On a Way, Awake Beloved from Hiawatha's Wedding Feast. Tenor Roderick Dixon is joined by the 2017 Colored Music Festival Orchestra under Kazim Abdullah for this performance.
Thank you.
tenor Roderick Dixon performing there alongside the 2017 Colored Music Festival Orchestra under Kazim Abdullah on Away, Awake, Beloved from Samuel Coleridge Taylor's Hiawatha's Wedding Feast. We return now to a few more words from Charles Elford, a biographer of Samuel Coleridge Taylor, who fills us in on the legacy of the composer.
Although it was a very different time, there are things which just seem so familiar to us today. And as I say, it did feel terribly unfair that he had slipped into obscurity. Just to give you an idea of the legacy of his life, apart from the music which he left behind, the first thing I have to say, this is quite an interesting one. Elgar wrote to Sir Charles Villiers Stanford, who ran the Royal College of Music, and Elgar was basically in his letter saying, you know, how well musicians were treated by their publishers. And Stanford angrily replied, and I'll read this to you. He said, "I am, of course, glad that your experience leads you to think that the big publishers are often everything that is considerate. I can tell you many cases where they are not, some horrible cases. If by accident you saw the accounts of Messrs. Novello concerning Hiawatha, it might open your eyes a little as regards the considerate treatment of our composers." So, you know, I think a lot of modern artists today who feel that they've been ripped off by their agents or publishers would be able to relate to that. And certainly his wife started a letter writing campaign to the London Times and to anybody who'd listen, basically saying that she should be entitled to some sort of royalty from his music. And in 1914, 2 years after his death, the Performing Rights Society was formed in the UK, and the aim of that was to ensure that musicians were paid a fair price for their work. So that is on the back. That massive sort of change was on the back of Coleridge Taylor's work and his wife's campaigning. And I suppose another part of his legacy was that every year after his death, right up until 1953, I think the last big production of Hiawatha, the trilogy, was in 1953 as part of the coronation celebrations of our current queen. So really from sort of 1912 right up until then, the centrepiece of the Royal Albert Hall's summer programme was an epic production of Hiawatha, starting off with the overture, the marriage, the death of Minnie Haha, and finally ending up with Hiawatha's departure. And it was again the first time this sort of production had happened. They had waterfalls on stage, they had a cast of hundreds, actors, dancers, massive orchestra, they had this backdrop that was slung from one side of the stage to the other, you know, which sort of depicted an Edwardian dream of an idyllic Native American life with sort of teepees and, as I say, waterfalls. There was a lake. It was just epic. And this ran year after year. But really, after sort of the early 1950s, they stopped. I felt it when I read that article in the Evening Standard back in 2004, that this is a person who doesn't deserve to be forgotten. And I had to ask myself, why had he been forgotten? Why do we remember names like Ralph Vaughan Williams, who he was at college with, but who was, you know, not a patch on Coleridge Taylor at the time? Coleridge Taylor was seen as the star pupil above people like Holst, who he studied with. Why do we remember names like Ralph Vaughan Williams and Edward Elgar? And we don't remember names like Coleridge Taylor. And I have to say, the only conclusion I can draw is that somewhere along the line, it was because of his race. I don't know that for a fact. It's always hard to know. Music does go in and out of fashion. He was conscious of that himself. He talked about the ebb and flow of sort of musical taste. But I think it's time that his life story and his contribution to the world of arts and race relations. I haven't really touched on his activism work. I mean, he was a founding member of a monthly publication called the African and Orient Review. He ran Pan-African conferences in London as well. And I suppose the last thing I'd like to say is really what his gravestone says, which is in a cemetery in Croydon, which was his home for his whole life and quite close to where I was brought up. And again, I was surprised when I heard that there was this great man that just lived a few, you know, a few miles away from where I was born and brought up, and I hadn't ever heard of him. But his gravestone just says, "Too young to die. His great simplicity, his happy courage in an alien world, his gentleness made all that knew him love him." And I think that really just sums him up. He was not only a great composer, he was not only a great musician, he was not only a great activist, he was not only great at bringing people together, but I think he was just a thoroughly nice bloke. He was kind, gentle, very, very bright, very, very funny. He was a lovely father, apparently, to his two kids. And his daughter, Gwendolyn, later changed her name to Avril, she would perform in the chorus at these Royal Albert Hall performances right up until they began to peter out in the 1950s. So, as I say, he really doesn't deserve the obscurity that he has now. And I think something is beginning to change. There's an orchestra called Chinique, and they start every one of their recitals with a piece by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. So may he go from strength to strength. I think maybe it's time that he had a little bit of a renaissance and that he came back into the public consciousness a little bit. One other thing I forgot to say, actually, when he went to America, he had a private audience with President Theodore Roosevelt, which again was an unprecedented honour. And it just makes me think, in a way, how far we've come and how much further we still have to go in terms of breaking down segregation and racism and, you know, realising that underneath it all, we're all pretty similar.
Well, Charles, I think we could talk a lot more about the life and legacy of Samuel Coleridge Taylor, but we'll have to leave it there for today. Thanks so much for all the fascinating insights and for all the work you've put into bringing more attention to this composer.
Well, thank you very, very much indeed for having me.
That was part of a conversation I had with Charles Elford, author of Black Mahler, The Samuel Coleridge Taylor Story. That does it for today's program of Sonatas and Soundscapes. Thanks so much for joining me, and until next time, take care.